Thanks for listening to the Not a Diving podcast. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our private Discord server, sign up at patreon.com/scubaofficial.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
This is not a diving podcast, but Scuba.
Welcome to the show. I'm Scuba. This is the Not a Diving podcast. Okay, before we get started this week, I've got to tell you that I'm playing some live shows. Yeah, brand new live set. I haven't played live since 2013, so this is a step into the unknown for me. I'll be playing London on June the 12th, Bristol on June the 13th, and Manchester on June the 14th, and it's going to be digital underground stuff. So my mixtape from last year, yeah, it's part two. There's new music coming this week and live shows in June. So head over to scubaofficial.io/live to check it out and cop some tickets and hopefully see you down there. scubaofficial.io/live. Yeah, London, Bristol, Manchester. Going to be fun. Right, okay. On the show this week. In fact, before we get to this week, I've got to say that last week with Steve Davis was one of my favorite episodes of the podcast so far, and lots of you liked it. So thank you for the messages telling me that you liked it. That's always good to get messages saying that you like the podcast. And in fact, instead of messaging me, you could actually leave a review on the podcast platform that you're listening to on. That would be better because I could still read it there, but we'd get the bump on the algorithm too. So do that instead of messaging me on social media. Also, that's fine. Please do that. If you like the show, then do whatever you want. Anyway, so the fact that that was such a good episode means that we've got something to live up to this week. And luckily, we've got a show which absolutely lives up to those expectations. It's James Ellis Ford, aka James Ford, sometimes just known as James Ford, but known with his middle name when he does solo productions. He's obviously a member of Simian Mobile Disco, but more importantly, maybe more importantly, just as importantly, equally importantly, he's one of the foremost producers of, I guess, credible pop music. Is that the right terminology? Certainly he's produced many of the biggest credible pop acts, certainly British pop acts, of the last couple of decades, and it really is an impressive list. Let's look at it, shall we? It includes the Arctic Monkeys, Depeche Mode, Pet Shop Boys. It includes Jesse Ware, Mumford & Sons, Foals. Wow, I mean, it just goes on. The list goes on. Gorillaz, Kylie Minogue. It's like, okay, lots of very, very well-known people have worked with James Ford on their records. And, you know, production is something that we are ostensibly interested in, but we don't talk about that much, really. We're not really a sort of technical kind of a show, although we do have lots of producers on. But that kind of production, pop music production, the production of bands specifically, is something a bit different. So this is a really, really interesting topic of conversation and an amazing person to dig into all that stuff with. So it's great to have James on. You're not going to be disappointed by this conversation. It's absolutely great. So yeah, strap yourselves in, basically. before we get into that, you've heard up the front that you can get rid of the ads with Patreon. Patreon.com/scubaofficial gets you through to that. You can also support the show financially if you feel the need, if you feel the desire to reward us for our efforts here by going over to scubaofficial.io/support. If you've got an Ethereum wallet with loads of Ethereum in it, you can send that directly to us via a link on that webpage, but also other means too. If you don't want to do that, if you can't do it, completely understand, all good. Follow the show wherever you listen to this podcast on whatever platform. I've already asked you to leave a review. That would be great. Please do that. Leave a 5-star rating. There's also a Spotify playlist. Link in the show notes to that playlist. Lots of James Ford productions in that playlist this week. And that's about it, isn't it, really? So I think without further delay, here is James Ford. James Ford, welcome to the show. How's it going?
Good, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. It's been a little while in the making, but no, finally here.
Yeah, sorry. It's been a bit of a kerfuffle trying to get it organised. I've had a little busy period, I'm sure you have too.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've just been looking at your recent production credits, and it's there's quite a lot there, isn't there?
I think it's... a case of if some of the records were done quite a while ago, and then maybe because of COVID or something like that, they all seem to be kind of coming together at once. But yeah, I've got like 10 records out or something this year, which is just insane.
Right. Is there anything forthcoming? What have you got forthcoming? Because I'm no doubt there's things you can't talk about, but what are the notable things you've got coming up?
Yeah, there's a couple I can't talk about, but the one I suppose that's kind of next that is one that has been sort of in the pipeline for a long time is the Beth Gibbons solo record.
Oh, yeah.
Which she's been working on for ages with the drummer out of Talk Talk, Lee, is sort of playing on it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and then I was brought in kind of ostensibly to help her get it over the line, but then that was another like 2 or 3 year process, and this is all about 5 years ago. She moves at the speed of a glacier, does Beth. Bless her.
She is a long-time collaborator of yours.
No, I've never worked with her before. No,
really, didn't she guest on a Simeon Mayall Disco album?
No, we wish. No, she's very kind of picky about that sort of stuff.
You know what? I think I'm mistaken.
Are you thinking of Beth Ditto?
Yeah. That's someone totally different, right? Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. That's Beth from The Gossip. No, this is Beth from Portishead.
Yes.
And yeah, she's done her own solo record a good few years ago with Rustin Man. And then she's obviously got the 3 Portishead records. But apart from that, you know, she did a classical thing as well recently. But she likes to take her time. But she's very meticulous, and she's very, you know, she has high standards, put it that way. But she's a wonderful person. I think her voice is incredible at this point.
I mean, yeah, absolutely. Storied in her contributions. I mean, obviously that first Portishead album, of course, but like, yeah, I mean, the subsequent stuff too, it's just amazing. I wanted to ask, well, I mean, I've got obviously lots of questions here, but I wanted to talk about, well, when I first started sort of researching this and trying to figure out what I was going to want to talk to you about, I had an idea about talking about moving from, you know, being in a band and being a sort of electronic musician, quote unquote, to doing production for other people. But actually, you've been doing this kind of from the start, haven't you?
Yeah, it's sort of been I've had a kind of two-pronged attack, I suppose. I sort of, like going right back, I always had it in my head that I wanted to be a producer, really. Even as a teenager, you know, I had a little 4-track and a, you know, an old synth in my dad's sort of basement. And yeah, I remember thinking as a teenager that would be a cool thing to do, sort of thing.
Yeah.
And then I ended up going to Manchester University and getting in bands and whatever. And one of those bands ended up being Simeon, the band. And we self-produced that, which was basically, you know, me and the other guys, but I was kind of pushing everyone else out of the way.
Right, that's as opposed to Simeon Mobile Disco.
Yeah, totally. So And then that was that. We got signed and moved to London and all of that kind of stuff in the early 2000s. And then that band sort of fell apart, and Simi Mobile Disco became this, I suppose, kind of side project thing. And then at the same time, I kept on the band studio, you know, and just kind of everyone else went and got proper jobs. And I was like, right, I'm going to try and give this production thing a go, and just did anything and then, you know, recorded anyone I could to just to kind of get my hand into that more, because, yeah, I suppose I've just always been fascinated in the mechanics of putting a record together. And then, yeah, played in various bands and done various stuff, but always had production, you know, on the, you know, on the, as the sideline. And then thing, I suppose, in different periods of my life, you know, I've been busier with, as an artist, I suppose, and production kind of takes a bit of a backseat. You know, even though, like, while I was making, you know, some of those Arctic Monkeys records and stuff like that, I was still going off on weekends and being a touring DJ and coming back totally exhausted on the Monday and, right. and, you know, doing my day job, if you know what I mean, which,
yeah, okay.
you know, I kind of marvel at my energy levels. You know, I don't think I could do that now. And then I suppose, you know, recently the thing that's happened is Jas from SMD has got sick, and that kind of put a pretty hard end to touring and that sort of stuff. And yeah, I was already sort of one foot out the door of DJ world as well, if I'm honest, you know, getting older as well. I've got a kid. I've sort of, the traveling started to take its toll on me and, you know, for my kind of health and stuff. So I just sort of, and then COVID came along as well. And I just, you know, I took a pretty sharp left turn and solely kind of, you know, concentrate on the studio now, really.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, the touring lifestyle is, well, it's attritional, isn't it?
Yeah, it is literally is a war of attrition. Yeah, I know it's the classic adage, but that's the bit you get paid for, I think. You know, I think every DJ would say they'd do the gigs for free, probably, you know. But the, you know, the grueling bit is the boredom and the anxiety and the, you know, yeah, just like damaging your health on a daily basis on, you know, getting on flights and having crap sleep.
Yeah. Okay. So, excuse me. I'm just talking about production specifically. What is your, okay. So a lot of people listening to this are going to be electronic producers, I think. I think that's my core audience. What is the role of a producer when you're working with a band like, say, for example, Arctic Monkeys, who don't have a lot of electronic elements to the sound? What do you do in basic terms?
It seems like a funny question, but it is, you know, I think the problem is producer is a very broad term.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
And it has shifted and changed even from, you know, the kind of 60s and 70s, really. You know, I kind of think about it as being the person that is responsible for getting the record over the line and finishing it, and basically having the skill set to do that in whatever way that sort of manifests. And that can be anything from, you know, on some production stuff I do, I am literally writing, playing everything, producing, mixing, you know, ticking all of the boxes. And sometimes it is more of what I would call the sort of old school traditional producer role, which is more the sort of overview, standing back, you know, sort of A&R sort of partly of it, you know, which is maybe the more kind of Rick Rubin approach or whatever, you know, not as hands on and just trying to steer the ship, as it were. And then also there's the whole kind of just making people feel relaxed and comfortable enough to, you know, be vulnerable in a recording situation and share their ideas and the group dynamics of all the different way people interact and, you know, giving everyone in that situation a voice and all of those kind of things. The thing that I personally like about it is different every time, you know, you're walking into a situation and people need different things from you, you know, and I feel I'm fairly versatile and can hopefully, you know, plug the gaps and help them finish the record they want to make.
Yeah, I think that kind of secret sauce of getting people in a position, a sort of headspace where they can deliver their own best work. That's something I find really interesting. And actually, you mentioned Rick Rubin. I think a lot of people listeners will have read that book by Rick Rubin, which came out recently. And, you know, I read it recently and a lot of it is on the surface, almost kind of mumbo jumbo, like Californian mumbo jumbo.
Yeah, it does wind me up a little bit, I must admit.
I mean, honestly, I've found it tough going through it. But then I think in the context of the necessity of a producer to get the best out of everyone making the record, I guess it makes a little bit more sense. I mean, can you give me a few examples perhaps of that kind of process in the studio in particular? Records.
Of what, the people management stuff?
Yeah.
I think, well, the, you know, like, I suppose the one that springs to mind that is quite an extreme example was working with Depeche Mode, not on this record, which had a whole odd set of circumstances, but ended up being very kind of calm and actually a very nice record to make. The one before was very tense, and it was my first time working with them, and we were in this kind of crazy place in Montecito, California, and, you know, there was like 15, 20 people in the studio, and the band were just not getting on. I don't know, you know, some people are obviously kind of rabid fans and probably know about all this stuff, but the dynamic between Martin and Dave, especially in certain times in their history, has been pretty tense, and Fletch was the sort of intermediary between them. And it often was around kind of Dave wanting to have more of his tracks that he wrote on the record, and Martin being, you know, obviously a brilliant and well-established writer and being sort of protective of that space to a certain extent. Mm. It all kind of flared up massively to the point where I got a phone call at 3 a.m. from the manager saying, you know, Martin's leaving the band type thing. So I had to like call off the session, sent everyone home. And then literally it was the next day was like four chairs with me facing the manager and Martin facing Dave. And the manager obviously has been their kind of manager for years, and sort of left it to me as the fresh voice in the room to sort of mediate this meeting. And it was literally like marriage guidance, you know, like, Martin, what would you like to say to Dave? You know,
wow.
Sort of kind of thing. And like in my head this whole time, I'm like, this is one of the most surreal moments of my life. You know, it is pretty bizarre. And, you know, they eventually worked it out and we finished the record, but, you know, like that's an extreme example, but, and I think once I've been through that kind of thing, it's sort of, everything else just feels, you know, at the end of the day, I feel like my presence, one of the best things you can do is just be a calm sort of, mediator, I suppose, and be honest and open and tell people the truth, you know, and just at the end of the day, it's, you know, it's making music. If you move forward slowly and everyone stays calm, you know, you'll get to the end of it, end of the record, and everything's going to be fine. You know what I mean? It's like there's a lot, a lot more serious things going on in the world. It's I think it's, you know, I think just being calm and open to it is as a producer is about the most you can do, really. It's almost like trying to like mediate a situation in the pub with your mates or whatever. You know, it's a similar thing. You just have to kind of think about what everybody is thinking, or you assume people are thinking in that situation, and try and help people kind of get through their issues.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, that does sound extremely surreal to me.
Yeah, there's a few of those. You know, like even just, I don't know. Yeah, I'm obviously in a lucky spot where there's a few kind of, I'm just, you know, those little zoom out moments where you're like, hang on, I'm just making coffee for the Pet Shop Boys in my kitchen. What is this? You know, like what parallel universe have I stepped into? You know?
Yeah, totally. So, I mean, as you were saying, I listened to a really long, like 4 hour long interview with Bob Ezrin not too long ago. Hmm. And he was talking about stuff like pre-production and getting, you know, not working on demos with artists, but like, you know, going into the studio during the kind of like, during the writing process and getting involved, really just, I guess, as a soundboard, as a kind of feedback kind of thing with certain acts. He actually talked specifically about doing that with Peter Gabriel, actually.
Yeah.
And saying to Peter Gabriel at one stage, you know, you're not ready to do this yet, and sort of sending him back for another
totally.
6 months. Yeah.
Yeah, that's brilliant if you can do that. It's, you know, it's a funny thing these days. I think demos is a very interesting, you know, word that keeps changing because, you know, sometimes, you know, I, as a producer, would prefer, you know, a very simple song demo on a guitar, or, you know, with a voice or something, you know, but that's very rare these days, you know.
Sure.
Often you're getting pretty much produced tracks, you know, as demos, and you're really then kind of sort of sorting through, you know, the elements that you like and the elements you don't like, and trying to kind of, you know, bend it to your will, as it were. And that's often quite a lot harder when things are further down the road, because, you know, some of those aesthetic decisions have already been made, you know, without you necessarily being there. I love getting in on the process early. But, you know, sometimes it just doesn't work like that. Sometimes you are being, you know, or I am being kind of, I suppose, employed to do the last 5 or 10%. But, you know, that's kind of tricky. And I feel like that's quite a modern thing.
I was going to say, is that a standard thing now? The standard thing for a producer coming to work with the band?
I wouldn't say it's the standard thing, no. You know, lots of people do come in with simpler demos, you know. But then I think because the capability is there for everybody now, people can take it further on their own, and that just creates a lot of its own problems, you know. Like one thing I have noticed, and I don't know, maybe I'm right about this, but maybe I'm not, but I feel like there's a younger generational thing of this kind of wormholing thing of, you know, basically having the access to the technology to get a demo 90% there, but not having the skills to get it 100% there. Mm-hmm. And then being able to, you know, just going round and round, and the indecisiveness and the, you know, not being able to finish, basically. And I feel like, you know, in the olden days, where you basically had, you know, a more stripped down demo or something, and you'd go into the studio and you had limited studio time, and, you know, you have all of these limitations, time being the biggest one. People made the decisions that it takes to finish and to kind of, you know, be happy with it and draw a line. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
And
necessity being the mother of actually getting things done.
Exactly. And now there's, you know, the democratization of music technology, which is a great thing, but also gives this opportunity for this never-ending spiral of, you know, oh, I can just tweak it one more time. Oh, I could just make that bit just that little bit better. And actually the discipline it takes to finish something is much bigger now, in a way. Do you know what I mean? With all the options and all the things that are afforded to you just on your laptop and, you know, sound card. So I think it's actually quite a problem, and it's a problem that I see, you know, in I suppose new, younger sort of musicians making music much more than in kind of, I suppose, older people that I've been working with, who are just very much like, oh, this, you know, this is the record, this is the, you know, they find it easier to let go, I think.
Sure. Democratization of music being a great thing. Just stick a pin in that, because I want to go back to that.
Yeah, of course.
But have you had any instances where people have come in with with demos, like you say, which are, you know, almost the finished track, where you felt the need to say, well, actually, a completely different approach to this song might be better?
Yeah, yeah, 100%. I often, you know, depending if the project allows, we'll record a couple of different versions of the tune, you know, and like, it, you know, there's that version that maybe is, they've taken all the way down the road. But if I think there's a better version that is, you know, half time or different key or, you know, totally different approach, then, you know, I think it's, people are quite open to that often. Let's just try a different version. You know, that version's great. It exists, you know, well, let's try another version and then we'll just pick our favorite one, you know? So that's often how I would approach it. You know, all of these things often depend on the process as well. You know, like the word, you know, pre-production that you said a while ago, that to me is very much a kind of old school approach as well, as if you're going to make a record in a way where you've got a bunch of people playing together in a room and maybe you're going to go to tape or something like that, you know, which I love recording like that for the same reasons that I was saying just a minute ago, of it forces you to make decisions, you know, and it forces people to choose the take. And, you know, if you want to do another take, you've got to record over the last one. You know, I'm not that bothered about the sound of tape necessarily. It's about the process it leads you into.
Right. That's fascinating. Yeah. Okay.
And for that, I think that, you know, pre-production is everything. That it's working it out in the rehearsal room. It's figuring out all of those little changes and dynamics and things ahead of time, you know, because that's how records used to be made. Sorry, sound like an old dude, but
yeah. Okay, let me just ask about that. Have you noticed a difference in attitude between older people, shall we say, and younger people coming to the studio these days with regards to that kind of stuff?
Yeah, I think the main way that I just sort of mentioned is the just the approach and the feeling that, you know, you're going to go in to a recording session and you're going to finish it. You know, it's not like speculative, really. It's like you're going to go in and you're going to do the things, and the way the things happen is the record. You know, it's like a photograph. It's a capturing of a moment, you know.
Yep.
Whereas that moment is much more diffuse in a modern way of making music, you know, and that can be great as well. You know, I'm not down on modern ways of making records. Those are like, people make incredible records on a laptop, you know, and nothing else, you know, and that's just, I don't know, for me personally, I find that way of music making more difficult, because it's the endless, just that, you know, the endless right. open-endedness of it that I find tricky. I like the, you know, the limitations. And I think in the modern age, you have to self-impose those limitations, you know, because otherwise you're just lost in the endless loop. Or I'm capable of tweaking and twiddling, and it's partly why I like to be busy. You know, it's like I've run out of time. I've got to deliver this project by the end of the week, so I've got to make these decisions now, you know, and I think that is very healthy. I think I find that's one of the most useful tools I have in my, my utility belt is to be like, sorry, I've got to finish in 2 weeks. You know, we've got to get this done. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, constraints of any sort really can be extremely useful. And we've often talked on the show previously about how technical constraints can be very useful too, you know?
100%. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you know, I often think, you know, I'm sitting in my studio and I'm surrounded by like these old bits of equipment or whatever. And, you know, at the end of the day, all of that, you know, on a sonic level, all of that is limiting your spectrum of your sound, you know, and doing things in a worse way, in a way than you can do on a fairly cheap laptop and a fairly cheap sound card. You know, the full range of the stuff that you capture, and the full range of dynamics and all of those things, it actually not what you want a lot of the time. You know, you're actively trying to, you know, mess it up in the same way as a, you know, an Instagram filter or something. But it's those things, now we're in the position where you have to again actively choose aesthetically to make those choices of using a certain kind of, you know, limitation.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. Okay, just to expand on the theme of it being better in the old days, which is...
I'm not sure I want that to be the tag.
No. This is actually a common theme on the show that we try and damp down as best we can, but it does come up quite often. It was something on TikTok that I was served, I think it was yesterday, and it was one of these, you know, I forget the name of the guy, and it's really annoying that I didn't write it down, but it was one of these kind of like legendary producers, some guy who had been, you know, he was talking about, you know, working with the Stones in the 60s and that kind of stuff. And he was talking about the difference between recording bands playing together and the technique of laying down like a kind of bass track of bass and drums or whatever, and then endless overdubs. Yeah. And what you lose there with the kind of interaction of the musicians, which comes through on the record, but actually also comes through in the writing of the track itself.
Yeah.
Can you give me your observations on that?
That's a thing that I go through quite a lot in the recording process with bands, obviously, less so with electronic stuff. But I do actually think there's still, in a way it applies to electronic music, as in it's great to have all the machines running along at the same time and you're kind of shaping it rather than doing one by one. Anyway, but that I'll pin that for now as well. But the thing about everyone playing, you know, it's horses for courses. I'm not saying one way is better than the other. It depends on the outcome you're trying to achieve and a lot of times. But having, you know, I'm a huge fan of the sound of a room and this, again, the kind of that feeling of trying to capture a moment in a sort of photographic type way. And I think if you are trying to achieve that kind of thing, having everyone playing together and, you know, I'm a big fan of the spill and, you know, all of those kind of things. And there's a slightly counterintuitive way you sort of do that in the studio. You know, you'd assume you're trying to get the most separation in the room. But, you know, once you've done it a few times, you know, if you put the piano too far away from the drums, then actually you're going to get these kind of quite clattery stuff on the piano mics that you're going to get anyway.
Right.
But actually, so it's better to put, you know, the piano or the bass or whatever it is actually closer in, you know, have everyone quite tight in, and then the spill is less kind of, yeah, kind of delayed and clattery, if that makes sense. So, you know, you see a lot of those old kind of 60s photos of everyone sort of sitting around tight, the Wrecking Crew or whatever, and they've all got these small little baffles around their instruments and their amps, but they're all sitting quite tight in together. Even orchestral stuff, you know, sort of strings and woodwind and things like that. And, you know, it's quite a challenge to record like that, but it does create this sort of special thing where, you know, and a lot of the decisions, normal mixing decisions, are taken out of your hands, really. You know, you know, if you want the piano a certain level, you're going to have to deal with the spill that's on there, you know.
Sorry if I can just interrupt you. It just struck me there, like, modern mixing is almost a science these days, but it definitely wasn't like that like 40 years ago.
Oh, no. Often they just do it at the end of the session, you know, get a balance up and that was it. Yeah. Often, you know, you can mitigate it with miking techniques and all of those kind of things. And, but essentially you are, at mercy of, you know, everyone playing together and everyone getting it right in one go and everyone's parts being organized enough for it to make sense and all fit together. But you're kind of capturing everything in one go, which is a, you know, if you can, I love that way of recording, if you can make it work, you know. But I'd say that's quite rare for people who are, you know, organized enough, rehearsed enough, wanting to do that, have the budget to do that. You know, it's not the common way anymore. But, you know, like, I'm a huge fan of a lot of records that have been made in that way. And I do think there is an energy that is captured like that. That being said, the sort of single tracking thing, you know, with, you know, if I'm recording a modern band, I would tend to get everyone in the room and do the basic track with everyone playing together, but with a certain amount of separation if, you know, if it's not that organized. And then actually the detail of, you know, getting the part just right, getting the sound just right to fit in, and have that done over the top of a kind of vibey rhythm track, basically. So you'd keep the drums and maybe the bass, and then, you know, and anything else that sort of is what you call the rhythm track. And then the more detailed stuff is overdubbed individually, you know, the whatever keys and guitar parts and production and vocals, backing vocals, you know, you do that with separation, you know, one by one afterwards. Yeah. I think that is probably the most common way of recording bands at this point in history, I think.
Yeah, I mean, that would make sense. Going back to, well, I mean, as you were saying that, I was kind of reminded of the second Arctic Monkeys track, which was the album, which is the first one I think you did with them. Mm. And their early stuff, generally speaking, it almost sounds like it was done in that kind of old school kind of a way. And that was 2007, I think. Like, first of all, I mean, yeah, that album in particular, just general comments. But like, my understanding was that these general kind of trends in production kind of happened over the course of the kind of late 90s to early mid 2000s. Is that roughly the timeline here?
Yeah. Well, you know, like Arctic Monkeys as an example, they've always been very much into the live thing, you know. So yeah, most of their stuff throughout their records has been recorded in as live as possible, you know, including the lead vocals quite often.
Really?
Okay. On the later records, we went more into the kind of Phil Spector-y thing of having a load of musicians all playing together, you know, and then maybe sort of overdubbing the vocals and that kind of thing, and some sort of special sounds, as it were. But yeah, you know, often there'd be lots of people in the room, or, you know, you do things like, instead of, you know, kind of getting everyone playing together, but not necessarily on their instruments, you know, get the whole band playing acoustic guitar or whatever, you know, or so you've got like five acoustics on one mic type thing. You know, there was a lot of that kind of thing going on.
Okay.
But yeah, so again, it's different on every record. But yeah, that early Monkey stuff was generally live performances with overdubbed vocals and maybe an overdubbed guitar or something like that.
Yeah. And then, yeah, the sort of the second half of that question, which was not that helpful, I realised, but just the kind of general lineage of production techniques. Because I guess, like, you know, like the late 90s was really the kind of like the end of the dominance of the big studios, wasn't it? I mean, you described before having, you know, building a studio with the with Simeon. You know, that's kind of, I guess, increasingly what bands did. You got an advance, you used it to build a studio.
Yeah, but that being said, it was like a really early PC with a crap sound card and boxes house. You know, it's not literally building a studio.
Yeah, sure. But you were able to make music, right? And I guess, and that's the kind of history of the last 20 years, is that that gradually becoming a whole recording studio in your bedroom, right?
Yeah, I felt actually, weirdly, I felt we were on the Simeon was sort of on the, we were right on the cusp of when it was possible to first make a record on a home PC sort of thing.
Yeah.
That kind of like, you know, 99, 2000. It felt like that towards, it didn't feel like that, you know, obviously people have made records, you know, there's loads of great 80s records that were, you know, made sort of, and even earlier than that, I suppose, but, you know, on like 8 tracks or whatever, just in a house and things. But yeah, in terms of the chronology, I think, I feel like, again, it's technology related.
Sure.
It feels to me like the move from tracking everyone as a unit, and, you know, the overdubbing stuff, kind of, it started to happen through the 70s as you know, especially in the late 60s, as you got 4 tracks and 8 tracks and that kind of thing. But then the real sort of multi-tracking stuff, it feels like quite an 80s thing to me in a way, you know, like sort of working on the individual parts sort of very specifically.
Maybe with the advent of drum machines, perhaps, that might have influenced
that. Exactly. And, you know, there's all the multi-track sort of, you know, multi-track tape machines then, I suppose late 70s as well. But I suppose it sort of became, it's definitely the standard all throughout the 90s and 2000s, you know, to do it like that. And, you know, early Pro Tools and stuff was, you know, and Radar and all those kind of things were around, you know, But, you know, I think in a way, like recording in an old school way now, what I would call it like a 60s or sort of early 70s, everyone in a room way, is an extravagance at this point. You know, it's, you know, you need a decent studio, you need a desk, you need quite a lot of good mics, you know what I mean?
And that's an enormous budget at this point, right?
Exactly. It's, you know, for music, it's a huge budget. Yeah. So really it's, you know, it is a luxury. And I, you know, I'm well aware of that when I'm doing it, but you know, each time I make a record like that, I'm like, is this the last time I'm going to be able to make a record like this? You know, it's, because now you can, you know, I'm in my home studio at home in my attic, and I've made load of records up here, you know, and this is a pretty well stocked one, but you know, I'd say the majority of records are not being made in studios anymore, really.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. So, okay. So going back to the democratization of music, is it actually good?
Is it actually good? Yeah. It's a double-edged sword at the very least, isn't it? You know, I think, obviously, it's great that, you know, I say it's great that everyone has access to making music. You know, there's a lot of stuff going on in the minute about, you know, sort of actual access to, you know, for, you know, people who have got sort of money in their backgrounds, or, you know, working class or poorer people having actual access to entrance into the music industry. And that's very up for debate. You know, I think we can still do a lot to level the playing fields in that sure. respect. You know, but then obviously leveling the playing field, you know, technology wise is a huge thing. You know, you can easily make a, you know, a huge kind of record that everyone listens to on very, very cheap equipment, you know, and, well, not very cheap, but comparatively cheap, you know, which is a good thing, undeniably. The other edge of the sword, I think, is just the noise, you know, the amount of stuff that's getting out there, and that is being made and generated, makes it, you know, exponentially more difficult for anybody to get heard above the hubbub, if that makes any sense, you know. And mm-hmm. you know, democratization is not just the technology; it's the, you know, the music distribution and all of those things, you know. And I'm very on the fence of what it actually means, you know. Obviously, anyone can make a record on a laptop and stick it on Bandcamp or whatever it is, put it on the streaming services. Will anyone actually hear it enough? I'm not sure. You know, there's a thing about kind of traction and the channels of, you know, I don't think, you know, something like Elvis or the Beatles could never happen now, because, you know, when one of those guys made a record, it was on every channel. People were waiting by the radio, and you know what I mean? It's like, it's ubiquitous. It was because there wasn't much other stuff around, really, in the way.
Yeah, I mean, even Taylor Swift today can't get anywhere near that level of reach, right?
Yeah, that's what I mean. The reach is not possible. Yeah, so, you know, even Michael Jackson, or what, you know, part of me is this kind of ever decreasing circles, or, you know, sort of ripples in a pond. You know, we're at the later stage of right. of popular music, if that makes sense. You know, and you know, so the I don't think it, yeah, I don't think it, you know, and the democratization adds to that. I do think there's all this stuff about, you know, and this is an odd thing to think about, but like kind of gatekeepers.
Yes, yes.
I think
we like gatekeepers on this show, I have
yeah,
to say.
And, you know, gatekeepers understandably have got quite a bad rap because it's
much maligned. Yes.
Yeah. it ties in with, you know, kind of patriarchal structures and all of those things that do need to be addressed, you know, boys club stuff. But sticking up for the for the boys' club. No, I'm not sticking up for the boys' club. But, you know, talking about gatekeepers, I do think there is...
I mean, to some extent, if I can just interrupt, to some extent, it's just quality control, isn't it?
Exactly. This is kind of... And also, it is something... There is something about creating these channels and, you know, people believing enough in an artist or a project or whatever it is to put money behind it and put their energy into talking about it and promoting it or whatever it is, you know, be it a label or a management or a journalist, you know. Those things are really important, I think, because, and even more so now, people need help to get their head above the parapet because there is just so much stuff out there. And that's only going to get worse.
Yeah, absolutely. It's definitely only going to get worse. But I mean, I think the addition I was just going to make to that was I think the audience needs help to navigate through this kind of swamp.
Exactly. 100%. You know, it's like, you know, you people need their sort of tastemakers and their, you know, whoever it is, Andy Weatherall's, John Peel's, you know, those kind of people. But, you know, honestly, there are those kind of people in the music industry still who, you know, believe in music and are championing music and pushing good music up. You know, there's obviously people who are only in it for the money, of course, but that's any sort of industry, I suppose. And I do think it's a wider issue as well with the onslaught of, like, you know, the total mess that the information landscape's going to be with AI and all of that sort of stuff. You know, everyone's very quick to tear down these kind of institutions, the BBC, you know, all the academic institutions and all that sort of stuff. But we're going to need those guys. We're going to need people who are willing to put in the extra effort to sort good information from bad, you know. And, you know, that I think that's the same with the democratization of everything, you know?
Yeah, totally. I mean, I guess I could generally think that democratization of music tech, okay, fine, good. Democratization of distribution, generally, not that great, you know?
Yeah. Going back to I do think the model of the music industry is still broken.
For sure.
You know, I'm in a very fortunate position. But, you know, comparatively, if you're trying to get into the music industry now, you know, like, you know, people aren't making a huge amount of money, really, comparatively to how they have through, you know, the recent kind of pop music history. And if people, you know, I saw James Blake said something recently about it. And, you know, I agree, if people do want good music, you know, they are going to have to pay for it in some way, you know, because...
Yeah, I mean, you do get what you pay for to an extent.
I do, yeah. And unless we kind of move to like a Medici model of, you know, people, rich kind of benefactors paying for people to make art, you know, it is
the,
just...
The radical gatekeeper model. That's I'm liking that.
Do you know what I mean? It's like that something does have to change. You know, the old school music industry is still in the way of... The streaming might work if it went direct to artists, but it's not. It's still going through the kind of old school music industry way, and they're still taking their 50%, 70%, whatever, you know. So I don't know, something does need to change in the long term, I think.
Yes, absolutely.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Really? So sticking on tech for a moment, and you mentioned AI, what are your thoughts on artificial intelligence in music, James?
I think it's going to be incredibly powerful. I've already heard things that, you know, are quite believable. My take on it is that I think in a similar way to if you work in graphic design or those kind of things, you know, if you're making music for adverts or, you know, even films to a certain extent, you know, TV, or even like kind of, you know, cookie cutter dance music stuff or whatever, your days are probably numbered. You know, it's quite easy to you know, you can imagine like and it's the same throughout all those industries, but you can imagine an advertising exec just typing into an AI, I want 10 versions of this song that, you know, won't get me sued or whatever, just putting in someone's track, and then it throws out 10 versions, they pick one and now give me 10 versions of this, and it, you know, it'll be totally untraceable. And that's putting, you know, thousands, hundreds of thousands of people who make that kind of music totally out of business, you know. And it's the same throughout loads of industries. And that's pretty dire. I do think, I suppose the thought, I don't think you're ever going to have an AI Nick Cave or an AI Leonard Cohen or an AI, do you know what I mean? There's the top level of creative people who make the music that I love. It's not just about the music, it's about the story and the person and, you know, the decisions they made to make that music in that way at that time, you know. And I can't see that ever being replaced, really, unless there's an AI personality that I'm invested in. Do you know what I mean? It's
well, I think that's completely possible, actually, to be honest.
No, that might be, yeah.
Yeah. Let me just ask a question I was going to ask, which was, I guess the observation is that there are two sides to this, aren't there? Because there is the we are going to replace you thing that you've just described.
Yeah.
And I think there's a...
Using it as a tool or whatever, yeah.
Sure. I mean, like with relating to the first thing, there's, I think, a really big question of regulation of this stuff, because the situation you describe with, you know, the kind of mythical evil advertising exec by punching in to the large language model, you know, make me a piece of music which is going to, you know, tug the heartstrings in the style of ... and that person not getting anything in return.
Yeah.
Like, it seems to me that one of the things we talked about on the show recently is the potential for government to actually do something good here in a way that it really didn't, governments across the world really didn't with regards to the last kind of like leg of the internet, which was just, you know, conspicuous by its absence in terms of effective regulation there. So that's something I think which could mitigate, but also I think kind of build into the music ecosystem something which is not entirely negative and maybe quite positive as well. But then, yeah, I mean, the other side of it, as you mentioned, like the kind of AI tools thing, which is potentially really useful and could actually add a lot to the process of making music.
Yeah, totally. I don't have much faith in governments in general at this point, but to regulate AI in a way that benefits the music industry, I'm not holding my breath, put it that way, unfortunately. And then the other thing about, you know, the sort of the copyright behind, you know, all of this information that has been sort of scraped, be it literary or, you know, music or the cultural aspects of humanity that are being fed into these AIs. I think the problem is it's so diffuse. I don't think it's going to be traceable in a simple way that can be monetized. I don't know. It's taking tiny elements across all of these different, aspects of human culture over the last however many years. You know, if it's a direct lift, fair enough. But, you know, even that within, you know, the music industry is a big grey area, never mind once you get an AI in there, you know. I don't know. It's tricky.
I mean, I guess the, absolutely is tricky, totally. I mean, I guess one of the, well, an example of this, not, I mean, it's not a direct example, but I mean the ongoing dispute between Universal and TikTok at the moment suggests that maybe the industry is kind of tooling up in a way which it perhaps didn't in an effective way previously. I mean, like, you know, the industry response to Napster was regrettable, put it that way, right?
Yeah, right.
And it seems like maybe the large rights holders, which have the power to protect intellectual property, maybe have got a better chance of getting it right this time, maybe?
Maybe, yeah. I probably don't know enough about it to know how achievable it actually is, but it seems to me from my point that it's quite a tricky thing to navigate. I don't know, you know, how would you even, you know, because if it's taking all of these inputs, you know, if you put in one song and say, I'll rip this song off for me, fair enough. But if you're just saying, make me a song, you know, in a happy, upbeat song in a 70s style, you know, whatever, it's like, you know, there's no one that can be, you know, are you going to send money to Tony Visconti? Or, you know, I mean, what's going to happen? You know, it's like, it's so broad that it's to the point that it's sort of meaningless. And maybe they're arguing that you're not allowed to feed new records into the AIs anymore or whatever, but I don't know.
Yeah.
I think the horse has already bolted, to be honest.
I mean, potentially, maybe. I mean, I think we're maybe early enough in the process that meaningful things could happen. I mean,
yeah, I'm sort of more worried, you know, I think that's a huge worry and it will have huge impacts on society, but I'm actually think they need to hurry up and legislate and control AIs purely on a, you know, human existential threat level.
But, well, right.
Know, I'd rather they sort that out first. Do you know what I mean? Because, you know, I don't even think they're going to get around to doing that in time, if I'm honest.
Yeah. I mean, I've just got visions of Sam Altman from OpenAI being a kind of like 20th century style kind of like figure of, well, dangerous figure, put it that way. I can't get that out of my head.
Yeah.
What do you think about, actually, hang on a sec, which question I want to ask here? Okay, so have you used any of these music tech AI tools yourself in the studio?
I haven't really, but yeah, I'm kind of interested in it. Yeah, as like you say, to use it as a tool, you know, I've obviously put like lyrics and stuff into ChatGPT, that kind of thing. I haven't, you know, really got anything out of it that I'm like, oh, that's amazing. But I haven't gone that deep into it either. You know, there's all the stuff on the technical level of like, I'm sure it already exists, but I haven't really been using it. But like, you know, EQ my voice sort of thing, or, you know, make this snare drum sound better. And, you know, I've seen a synth GPT where you like make me a spooky piano sound and, you know, it makes you one of those, you know. So again, it's fascinating how much, you know, I'll actually use it. You know, it wouldn't surprise me if you could just, you know, put your Pro Tools session into a GPT and get it to mix it for you and master it for you.
Oh yeah,
you know,
sure. Yeah.
That's obviously here now, probably, or right around the corner. You know, whether or not it's gonna be good, I don't know. You know, like would I want that or not? For me personally, you know, I think, again, for me, it's a huge part of music that I love is that you can hear the humanity and you can hear the mistakes and you can hear the imperfections and the stuff that they didn't do right, or, you know, that's a huge part of the music that I love, you know, and there's something about, I feel like AI tends towards this kind of idealized perfection that I think just comes across as sort of anodyne. And, you know, obviously the algorithm might get stronger and it can inbuild, you know, all these imperfections, but that's such a convoluted thing. You know, you've almost got to model a whole human's life. Do you know what I mean? to make the same mistakes that they would make or something, you know, for it. I don't know. Yeah. Fundamentally, on a creative level, I'd rather make those mistakes myself and put out a slightly shonky sounding record than have an AI mix it for me, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it strikes me that one of the things that will kind of play out over the next couple of decades will be that value increasingly flows to things which are not done by AI, basically. So as you said, like if you're doing very squarely sort of commercially focused work in whatever field, whatever creative field or whatever other field, things that can be done by AI will just become less and less valuable for obvious reasons.
Yeah.
And then the things which are only able to be done by a human will become more valuable.
Yeah, well, I had this same thought. And I think the tricky bit is when you can't tell. And I was wondering if maybe someone's already invented this, but I feel like there's probably a use for a, you know, like a rubber stamp, a digital rubber stamp of this was made by a human. Do you know what I mean?
Right. Like, I mean, that's the kind of regulation, I think, government regulation, which they definitely could do.
Yeah.
You know?
Like, say you're going for some like online therapy, you know, you're going to pay an extra fiver for like an actual human. Do you know right. what I mean? Like,
or maybe not.
Or
in
maybe
the case
not. Yeah, you're going on Spotify and I actually want a human playlist rather than an AI one.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think like, for example, that I think over the course of the last 20 years or 30 years, say, people play instruments way less. Like it's way less common to be good at an instrument. Mm. And I think that could go in reverse over the next 30 years.
Yeah, I hope so. You know, I think there's a huge, you know, I love playing instruments, even ones that I can't play very well, because I think there's a huge value in a physical interaction,
yeah.
You know, with a thing, you know, you're trying to press the buttons and blow the thing or whatever it is, you know, and there's just something so much more kind of, I know for me personally, satisfying about getting even, you know, a quite wonky noise out of a bass clarinet or something, rather than getting the one on contact and playing it in, and it sounds kind of cool, but it, you know, it's better recorded and it just doesn't have a vibe, you know, and I think whatever that is, that bit of vibe, you know, I hate the word, but you know what I mean, is the thing that I think AI is going to struggle to get, I think.
Yeah. And I think that people will appreciate that increasingly, I think, as the
I
kind of
so,
just
yeah.
flow of stuff, which is, as you say, slightly anodyne and cookie cutter, just becomes a torrent.
I do like the idea of, though, when we get into the future about like AI racism, like, you know, why are AI things less valuable than human ones? You know what I mean? Right. It's like there's some campaigning.
There will be a movement in favor of to take AI. Equality for AI.
Exactly.
Right?
You know, why are AI ideas worth less, you know?
Right. Okay. Okay. So there was something specifically I wanted to ask you about concerning recent work. Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned the Depeche Mode, the couple of Depeche Mode records that you've done. I mean, the most recent one was last year. And you also did the Blur album last year.
Yeah.
And you also mentioned Pet Shop Boys, and that album was coming out next month, is it? I think.
Yeah, it's coming out pretty soon. Yeah.
So, yeah, I wanted to ask you about, generally speaking, working with legacy acts, let's put it that way.
Yeah.
Who have very well defined audience expectations.
Oh yeah, it's a tricky one.
Yeah. So yeah, go on.
No, go on. Yeah, it's you do feel a bit like you're kind of wading into the lion's den a little bit. Because there's this well-loved history. You know, I do think with all of those three acts you mentioned, they've been consistently productive. And, you know, it's not like they're just trying to recapture former glories all the time. You know, they've been consistently making music and trying to move forward. And I think that that's a hugely important thing for me, as a decision point of whether I'm going to get involved or not, because, you know, if they hadn't made a record for 20 years, that pressure would be so much greater. You know, it's like all of those acts have been making records.
There was quite a big gap between the Blur.
Yeah, that's
albums,
that's true. But then obviously Damon's and Graham, right, sure. You know, have all been, you know, gorillas and solo projects and all these things. So they've still got their hand in, if you know what I mean. They're still trying to move forward. You know, I think there's nothing kind of more sad in a way than trying to get back to your younger self, you know, and trying to recreate that energy you did when you made a record, you know, that I find that quite tragic. And that, but I really don't think any of those acts are trying to do that. You know,
I mean, it's fascinating, isn't it? Because I mean, I think quite a lot of the audience would like that.
Yeah. Of course. Yeah. Yeah. But you know, I've had it to a huge extent, even with the Arctic Monkeys, you know, it's like they've changed stylistically so much through their career that, you know, people are like, oh, I hate this new style. You know, I love it. You know, what happened to the old style and whatever. And it's like, you know, it's not really in, I can't change the way people write, you know, and the things that they're trying to achieve. I, you know, my job is helping them achieve what they want to achieve, if that makes sense. And, you know, it's, and I've always had kind of the most respect for artists, be it, you know, Bowie or the Beatles or whoever, who are consistently moving forward and, you know, to whatever extent taking their audience with them. Mm. And, you know, I don't have a lot of time for people who keep treading the same water, even though treading that same water is probably the most commercially viable thing to do, you know, and a lot of the big acts kind of do that. And, you know, they meet their audience's expectations pretty much every time. And that's a successful strategy. I just think it's a bit boring, you know? So I think, you know, I think moving forward and making those kind of, you know, later period records for me is an interesting thing in itself. It's never going to have the same feeling as those first records by whatever acts, you know, because it's a totally different context and it's a different time in their lives. And often people can't write from the same place as they were when they were, you know, 20 or whatever.
Sure. I mean, especially when you're really rich and successful.
Yeah, you know? Exactly. You know, but I do think, you know, obviously writing from rich and successful is quite difficult. But I do think there is, like, there's a sort of ageism in music in general. Mm. And I personally really like sort of weird later period records where, that, you know, as long as the artist is being kind of authentic to who they are now, you know, I think it's really interesting. I love hearing people's voice change over a career and how they sort of settle into their kind of middle age or whatever it is. I think it's fascinating, and if it's done well, they can be some of the best records, I think. But they're never going to be those early records, and people just need to accept that. Do you know what I mean? And so I'm sort of, you know, I've made enough records now that I don't really bother about what people say. I just try and do the best thing I can in that moment. I think, you know, especially with people like Depeche or those kind of things, that they have such a crazy level of fandom. You know, I'm not on that level of fandom. I'm a fan, but I'm not like sort of, oh, I prefer this B-side over this, you know, the mono mix of this B-side over this thing. You know what I mean? I'm not on that level, and I don't think it would be healthy to be in the studio with people if I was on that level of fandom. So I'm just, just trying to help them kind of present the songs that they're writing at this period of their life in the best way possible. And that's as far as I can go with it. You know, obviously in my head as a, you know, it's like, oh, I'm going to go make a Depeche Mode record, you know, in my head, it'd be one thing and I would do this and that, you know what I mean? And make it sound like this. But actually when you're in the room with them and they've got these songs and they've got these aspirations and, you know, I feel like I push pretty hard and pretty honest, and I kind of steer it as much as it's steerable, if that makes sense. But I'm making their record, you know, and at the end of the day, the songs are the songs, you know. I'm not writing the songs. I'm not. Do you know what I mean? So it's like there's only so much you can do to a certain extent to make the record you want to make.
Sure. I mean, as you were saying that, I was reminded of the recent Rolling Stones record, which I mean, I'm not a particularly big Stones fan or anything, but I mean, obviously I know I'm fairly familiar with the catalogue, put it that way. And when I put that on, the songs on that record are recognisably Rolling Stones songs that which could fit in almost anywhere, I think, probably in the catalogue. And I found myself wishing that they just made it sound like Sticky Fingers, and production wise, I mean.
No, you know. It's a tricky balance to strike, you know, and you know, I definitely am aware of, you know, say with the Pet Shop Boys thing, you know, the you know, West End Girls is an incredible sounding record. You hear it now, it still stands up as a brilliant production, I think. You know, and obviously there is a part of you in that moment. It's like, I want to make it sound like West End Girls, you know what I mean? Or whatever, you know. And there is an element to, you know, I did use old drum machines and synths, but then you also can't go, it's like making a totally slavishly retro record is also a mad thing to do. Do you know what I mean? It's the same as I've been down this road a few times trying to make a record that sounds like Scott Walker or aping someone's or a particular record's production style too hard. It doesn't come across very well. Do you know what I mean? It's a weird thing to do. You know, like you can be influenced by things and you can head towards a thing, but then you've got to find your own thing on the way to it, you know, or at least trust that something is going to happen to give it a point of difference. Because otherwise it's like this kind of weird fetishism or something. Do you know what I mean? It's
absolutely do. Yeah. I mean, the thing about dance music though.
Yeah, exactly. I've tried to make like total Chicago house ripoff song. You know what I mean? It's like...
No, but what I was going to say is like the whole genre at this point is super nostalgic.
Yeah.
Like the whole thing is so, I always use the words like small C conservative in its kind of sonic approach and its kind of influences. And particularly, I think in the last 10, 15 years, I mean, not a lot has happened really in the development of dance music in that time. I mean, obviously there have been trends and stylistic shifts and stuff, but like, you know, not much has happened. And it did strike me making a Pet Shop Boys record. They're a pop band basically, aren't they? Yeah. I mean, it's fair to say. I mean, obviously it's dance pop, but I think, you know, going back to the thing, like the quote unquote classic era, Pet Shop Boys was very much a dance music focused production style.
Yeah, the Bobby O stuff and totally.
Yeah,
of course it is. Yeah, and you know, I don't get me wrong, I love classic dance music sounds and even the methods of production and all of those things. And there are some of those on the record, you know. But it's just hopefully...
Can I ask you... Sorry, in fact, finished.
No,
sorry.
No, it's just hopefully balanced with something newer, you know.
Mm. I was going to ask, can you be specific in how you guys made the record? I haven't actually heard it. Obviously, it's not out yet, but I was too late in asking to send it over before we did this. But
Well, you know, it was... They have pretty well-formed demos, like we were saying before, which, you know, almost versions of the song, but like mainly produced with sort of soft synths and, you know, fairly kind of quickly put together in a demo-y way. You know, I don't think they would say they were finished tracks or whatever, but fairly well fleshed out with, you know, good guide vocals and all of those kind of things and structures and stuff. And really, you know, I found it easier to do, especially electronic stuff in my place. So they just came round to my house every day. We'd sort of open up, you know, import their files into a session and then kind of listen to the tune and talk about it. And then, you know, I'd basically go through and, you know, reprogram, you know, the bass and the synths on, you know, real synths or whatever, and drum machines. I've kind of got most of the classics sort of knocking around. So I would do that and, replay or, you know, rewrite some parts and that kind of thing. And then they'd be sort of steering me along as I did it. Oh, I like that. That's cool. What about, you know, a sound a bit like this record and, you know, play some reference or something like that. You know, go and get coffee, come back and, you know, Chris would generally have a little nap on the sofa and I'd carry on sort of programming. Neil would be telling stories about, you know, hanging out with various people and, you know, weird, you know, just weird politics and stuff. And, you know, they're very easy and lovely to be around. And that was it, really. And then basically the whole premise of it was... they actually liked this kind of thing called The Last Shadow Puppets, which was a side project from the Arctic Monkeys that I played in that had lots of strings. I've been doing a lot of kind of probably overdoing the amount of string things that I put on records at the minute, but I'm very into orchestral arrangements and those kind of things. So I was kind of writing these orchestral arrangements in sort of Kontakt or whatever. And the idea was to have these quite sort of stripped down, I suppose, quite kind of chunky 80s sounding electronic instrumentals, but then with this quite 3D, Scott Walker-y, lush sort of cinematic string element to it as well.
Nice.
So we basically, you know, the kind of dichotomy between those two things was the sort of the thing they were we were interested in. And Neil sort of did most of his vocals just in here, standing behind me. You know, he had a very, he's got a kind of great voice, and he basically has this very specific thing that he does where he triple tracks everything. So he'd sing it once, it was like, oh, that's a good take, and then he'd sing it again. And then when the third track goes on, it instantly sounds like Pet Shop Boys, which is really odd.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it just has this kind of, because he's quite tight in how he sings with himself, and there's this kind of chorus it creates with the three voices interacting that's just like, oh, that's that sound, you know, which is,
wow.
You know, I was like, that, you know, working with these older acts, sometimes it's like there's these little things that happen where, you know, with Blur, it was like Damon's sort of songs. And then kind of Graham comes in at this quite sort of slightly antagonistic right angle with kind of the angular sort of way he plays over Damon's stuff. And it's like, oh, that's
Blur.
Two thing. That interaction is Blur. You know, without that, it isn't it. You know what I mean? It's just seeing those little moments, you know, for me is fascinating. But yeah, and then, so anyway, we just finishing off the process quickly, we went into a studio called The Church in London, which is a big room, and we did some brass and
Crouch End.
Crouch End, yeah. Did some.
That's where I grew up.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's a beautiful room, actually. It used to belong to, like, the Eurythmics and stuff, I think.
Yeah, it's Dave Stewart's studio. He built it, yeah.
But, yeah, so we did strings in there with, like a 20-piece and some brass and stuff, which is pretty extravagant but really kind of amazing. Again, it's the sort of thing that you can do it on Spitfire or whatever and it sounds cool. You know, it's like you can almost convince yourself it's it. Do you know what I mean? But then you go in and just do the same parts but with real people playing, it's like, oh my God, it was nowhere near it. Do you know what I mean? And it's really indefinable what that difference is. But anyway, so then I brought it back here and I mixed it. It was pretty straightforward. They were lovely to be around. And yeah, I think the writing is great. There's some great kind of great moments on it, I think.
So returning to the original question, like how concerned were they with how the record sounded, quote unquote? Like how concerned were they with being sounding up to date or being, you know, or maybe sort of harking back to certain previous eras of their, you know, yeah, their production, whatever?
We didn't really have those specific conversations about trying to make it sound like one of their old records. Again, they've been making records fairly consistently. I think they just want to make a good sounding record that incorporate the elements that they really like. Do you know what I mean? And I don't think the analysis went sort of deeper than that, really. You know, it was just, oh, this feels exciting, let's go towards here. You know, they were very involved in the production. They, you know, I would do certain things, they'd be like, oh, I don't really like that sounding a bit too much like this or whatever, you know, this one's feeling great, and oh, I love that sound, or, you know, can we put a little kind of, you know, high synth line that sounds a bit like The Chase on it or something. You know what I mean? There's like lots of, you know, they've made lots of records now, so they know what the parameters of making a record are to a certain extent. So it's quite a bit easier, I find. You know, it was really, there was sort of hardly any dead ends or struggles. We were just kind of got on with it, and it was it kind of came together pretty quickly and was a really nice experience. I don't know. Sometimes a more kind of fraught recording process can be yield its own rewards. You know, that kind of friction can be great in a way, you know. And I think Blur do have that, you know, as a recent example, you know, they're, I was kind of making those two records at the same time, and, you know, making the PSB record was kind of a holiday from the chaos of a Blur record, which was, yeah, you know, there's a lot more kind of sort of interpersonal and sort of things going on, and you know, they're incredibly creative and brilliant, but just sort of bonkers as well. And yeah, like I was very sort of taken aback by how chill and kind of sort of sorted and how the Pet Shop Boys are. You know, they seem to get on great, and there's sort of, they leave space for each other to kind of be creative, and they, you know, go out for dinner together every night, and you know what I mean, they seem just like really good friends. Yeah, you know, and
that's lovely, isn't it,
to maintain that over 40 years or whatever it is. Is amazing, you know. And it sort of reminded me a bit of, you know, like me and Jas, you know, like when you have this DJ partner thing, it's quite a strange, you know, it's like being married, honestly, you know. And often you spend more time with your, you know, your DJ partner or musical partner than you do with your family. And you build up this very sort of deep relationship, you know, and I definitely noticed that in the Pet Shop Boys, you know. And you know, you have to have kind of personalities that kind of match, I suppose, or, you know, what's it called? Sort of symbiotic or sort of something. Yeah, complement each other.
Yeah. Actually, the first rock/pop gig that I went to when I was a kid was the Pet Shop Boys at Wembley Arena in 1991 as a 12-year-old. I mean, I love them forever, really.
Yeah, yeah.
Amazing.
I think as well, they're very up to date. They're very switched on, you know, with like modern music and modern art, and, you know, they're curating their image and their brand, their music, their visuals, you know, they're all over it. You know what I mean? They were very impressive in that respect. You know, they were on top of things.
Yeah. So Blur, it's funny you mentioned the relationship between Damon and Graham's playing being the kind of secret source there. It really reminded me of, I mean, I'm a long time Guns N' Roses fan. I remember being astonished to read that Slash said that Izzy Stradlin was the most important member of Guns N' Roses because without his rhythm playing, they didn't sound like Guns N' Roses, you know, which I guess it's the same sort of thing. But yeah, can you be a little bit more specific about the recording of that record? I mean, yeah, I know you'd worked with Damon a fair bit before, but was that your first time with the rest of the guys?
I'd worked with Graham as well. He does this thing with his partner called The Wave, which we're doing another one of as well, which is... So I'd met them both individually and worked with them both individually. And so I think that was partly maybe why they asked me to come on board. And yeah, you know, I was, again, a teenage sort of fan of them. And, you know, said yes with some trepidation, if I'm honest. You know, like, what's it going to be like? I know that it's been fairly fractious, especially over the last few kind of records, and was kind of expecting a total shit show, to be honest. You know, part of me as well, like having been through the Depeche thing that I described earlier or whatever, I'm sort of like part of that I find quite exciting in a way. The music is one part, but I do actually love the sort of politics and the stories and all of that stuff. Yeah, now yeah. It doesn't worry me as like, I think if I'd, you know, tried to make that kind of record 20 years ago, I would have been so riddled with stress and anxiety. I wouldn't have been able to do a decent job. But now I kind of take it all with a little pinch of salt, and I find it fascinating, honestly. And so, and yeah, just to be in the room with people you look up to like that and have kind of grown up with is a trip, honestly. It's quite mad. You know, I remember one of the first days, Graham wasn't there and we were sort of running through some songs and just sort of standing in the room and I'm playing Graham's parts and the rest of the band are all playing theirs. I'm like, literally, this is what I wanted to do when I was 13, like be Graham Coxon. Like, what the fuck is happening? You know, but, yeah, I think everyone in the band was pretty nervous about coming back together and about how it would go, and because, you know, it's obviously been a bumpy road for them. But, you know, Damon wrote most of the demos and the demos were great, honestly. And my approach was just to hit the ground running and get everyone playing all together. And, you know, we were sort of playing with the demos, sort of playing over the demos just to get a vibe going. And we actually went as quick as we could, basically, for the first sort of, you know, week. And we're doing two or three sort of rough tracks a day, just getting some ideas down and getting everyone playing. And then everyone started to loosen up and feel a bit more relaxed, you know, sort of after that sort of first week. And then we just got into it in a, you know, a pretty standard way, like having them all playing together, overdubbing, like I was describing earlier. And yeah, it started to feel pretty good pretty quickly, you know, and that was all sort of done in Damon's place in London, but then we ended up doing a bit down in, Damon's also got a place in Devon where he's kind of starting to build a studio in a barn. And we sort of went down there and finished it off and did most of the vocals down there. You know, Damon has this quite odd process where all the songs are kind of rhubarb lyrics, you know, at the beginning. And then he has this sort of slightly torturous period after, you know, so basically the instrumentals were done and then he kind of had to go away for a few weeks and fit lyrics to these kind of rhubarb lyrics, but with, you know, but making them sort of make sense, but have the same vowel sounds and all, you know what I mean? So it's quite a puzzle the way he approaches it. But I think he's always sort of done that. You know, he's incredibly sort of, he was like a fountain of ideas in terms, you know, he's very used to just improvising, making stuff up on the spot. And he's a great piano player. You know, he will just sort of do things right there in front of you. You know, he's got a lot of kind of confidence in that way, and a lot of times it's brilliant. But I think the finishing off stage of it is the hardest bit for him. You know, I think that's the bit that feels a bit like work. But then once he got through the lyrics and we got those down, it started to feel really good. But yeah, it was pretty crazy, you know, the sort of lots of sort of weird late nights and, you know, they were just funny jokes and funny stories. And it was chaotic, you know, because Damon can make things up so quickly, he's sort of liable to, if something isn't working almost instantly, he's very impatient and he's liable to be like, oh, let's just throw this whole idea.
Try something else, yeah.
Yeah, you know, which as a producer, it's like, it can be quite sort of destabilizing, you know what I mean? And then Graham's sort of similar in a way that he's so creative as a guitar player, you know, he'd be playing something and it'd be like, oh, that's great. You know, let's do a take of that sound and that part or whatever. And he'd be like, okay, yeah. And he'd play. And then, you know, a minute into the song, like all the pedals have come on and he's like, do some weird elephant noises or something. And it's like, that's good too, but can we get a take of the thing before? You know, it's like herding cats a lot. You know, Damon would be like playing a piano part. And then again, he'd get like halfway through the song and just like stand up and walk out. It's like, what are you doing? You know, he's sort of... They're quite sort of ADD or something, but
right.
Anyway, yeah. So it was sort of chaos.
But did they manage to get on okay then? Did they?
Yeah, they did. Yeah, it was. Yeah, again, I was expecting a bit of a shit show, but I think after yeah, for whatever reason, after a little while, you know, it was like long lost brothers, and there was lots of stories about, you know, I don't know, kind of hanging out on a viaduct and, you know, smoking weed and like nearly jumping off and like playing chicken with cars and getting beaten up in Colchester, you know, like just lots of like, oh, do you remember that time? You know,
so did they go to school together?
Yeah. I think they met at like, Damon and Graham, especially, were like old friends, I think. So yeah,
because I mean, they were very young, weren't they, when Blur first?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they were, you know, I suppose teenagers, like a lot of bands are, you know. And I think it does, you know, same with Depeche, same with the Monkees. It does make you slightly mad if your whole life becomes this thing, you know, and you're still in your teenage years or whatever. It's hard to maintain a sense of reality, I think.
Yeah, I mean, have there been? I mean, you've worked with some very famous people. Is there anyone in particular who? I mean, maybe you don't want to name them, but like, who stands out as being a bit crazy as a result of that sort of thing?
I think they all are a bit sort of crazy. Like, but they're all really nice and good to hang out with. But yeah, there's just sort of sometimes there's this element of like, I suppose just having a different upbringing. It's, you know, it's like growing up in I don't know, with your dad in the army or something. I don't know, you know what I mean? Or some, you know, there's just something that I can't relate to in terms of how their life has gone, you know. And, you know, they're like quite like, obviously have lived in this slightly, you know, they've been looked after their whole life. So that, you know, when it comes to actually doing practical shit, or, you know, that they can't book flights, or, you know, right, I can lose the keys all the time. I don't know. You know what I mean? It's just like little details like that, you know. It's, you know, they've often been enabled their whole life. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's a funny thing. Yeah, in terms of particular anecdotes, there's probably quite a few, but nothing's jumping right off my top of my head at the minute.
Yeah, I mean, I've got a couple of people coming up on the show who have been really, really famous. And I'm very interested to kind of try and drill down into that with them. Excuse me.
It's a really weird thing. I remember something that like Beth Gibbons said to me, that like just the sort of anticlimactic sort of aspect of it, of, you know, I think, I imagine lots of people think this way, but she definitely sort of said something about, you know, the first bit when you're kind of getting into it, you're just like, oh, maybe I'm going to sort of make this music and maybe it's going to go well and maybe you'll get the respect and, you know, do big gigs and get awards and all those things. And, you know, and then when those things actually materialize, you realize there's nothing there. It's, do you know what I mean? It's like a wasteland. There's like, it doesn't mean anything and it doesn't give you any happiness and it doesn't give you, do you know what I mean? It's like, it's this kind of illusory place that doesn't exist. And then, you know, with a pretty kind of well-known people that I've been out with, it's a massive pain in the arse. You know, you're just getting people coming up asking for your photo while you're just trying to have a nice dinner, or, do you know what I mean? Those kind
imagine
of things. It's just actually a grind, you know, I suppose, you know, especially if your main motivation is just to, you know, make music and then you've just got all of these other aspects to your life that you can't control and that are quite invasive. And I don't, you know, covet it at all. You know, it looks pretty grim.
No, not at all. I mean, it's sort of what we were talking about with the way my legacy acts come back sometimes. Well, we were talking about, you know, the way acts to a greater or lesser extent, you know, go for their classic, quote unquote, classic sound. And I was reminded of, well, I mean, there's a couple of examples that I always kind of point to on this, of acts which had a kind of mid period where it went a bit kind of more experimental and they came back to their classic. I mean, U2 being the obvious one, but I also think about Metallica in this kind of way. And I sometimes wonder, maybe the motivation for doing that is sort of missing that kind of unambiguous adulation from the fan base, right? And how maybe the fun of it, when you've, if there is still fun to be had at that point, it's actually playing shows and having, you know, being validated, basically, yeah, by the people that...
I'm sure it's hugely addictive to get that kind of dopamine hit of that, you know, that crowd interaction or whatever. I don't know, like, I can't relate to it, really. I did my own thing recently and, like, did some gigs, and I just hate being the center of attention. Like, but I get a little dopamine rush from, you know, when a thing comes together in the studio and you're like, oh, this is, feels really good, and you get the goosebumps, and that, you know, that's the bit that I'm, the addictive bit that I'm chasing. But if, for some people, if that addictive bit is, yeah, is the, you know, camera glare or whatever, you know, the being on stage and all that, then yeah, it's, I suppose you're constantly chasing that, and it's got to be pretty empty feeling. I don't know. I always found that even with the DJing, you know, you do get that little buzz, but I don't know, it's very transient, you know, and then
it is.
And then the rest of it is long, you know what I mean? It's sort of the roller coaster, the peak in the roller coaster is very short, and
yeah,
and the payoff, I don't know if it's worth it for me, especially as I get older, you know. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah. I've been doing a very, very much reduced DJ schedule. And I have to say, I do sort of, in the down periods, I think, oh, I'd quite like to play a gig. But then when I'm out there, I'm like, oh God, this is a bit of a pain in the ass, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a funny thing, isn't it? Yeah, I don't know. It's, I still have a lot of kind of love and appreciation for that culture and the music and everything. But I feel so far removed from it at this point. It's quite scary. It's quite odd in a way, you know. I almost like sometimes, like, you know the David Byrne thing about you know, making music for the place that you feel like it's going to be appreciated in, you know, be that a punk band in CBGBs or a stadium rock band playing all slow and, you know, because of the reverbs, Gregorian choirs not been able to change note too quickly because of the long reverb, all of those kind of things. You know, I feel like club music is very specifically tailored, you know, and the best club music, it's very functional for a great sound system and a room full of people and that sort of stuff. But then I also find that if you're not often in that environment, which I'm sort of not at this point in my life, the music doesn't make that much sense anymore. Do you know what I mean?
It's like you hear it
through little speakers at home, and you know, you hear this kind of pretty sort of stripped out techno or whatever. I'm like, what is it going to do something in a minute? You know what I mean? Like you're sort of, and I remember like thinking like, I love that this doesn't do anything. It's amazing. You know what I mean? Yeah. And like, this one little thing happens and like your time base is stretched or something. And
yeah,
and it makes total sense, you know?
Well, I mean, that's actually, it's a point of debate in dance music now, is the kind of TikTokization of dance music, you know, and how much of the music is consumed via social media these days and the effect that that's had on the music, but also on people, the kind of expectation of people who go to clubs and festivals to see it live, you know?
Yeah.
Because like to what you know, yeah, to your point about, you know, David Byrne's thing about, you know, the context being important. If the context is a 15-second clip on TikTok, then, you know?
Yeah, totally. I can't, you know, I can't see TikTok being the be-all and end-all. You know, I feel like it's another medium and it's this very short little snippety thing, but I can't imagine music being reduced to that. Do you know what I mean?
Not entirely, no.
That some audiences are maybe used to that. But I remember a similar thing with the kind of EDM thing where it all got super rocky and, you know, dubstep came in and it was all kind of super everything up to 11 thing. And then it's that just sets a different precedent, doesn't it? And then if you're kind of DJing before or after one of those kind of acts and you're playing something that doesn't have those crazy dynamics, it's flat in comparison. So it's, you just have to be choosy about what kind of places, you know, you have to curate the places that you play and much more kind of strictly, I suppose, to not be, I suppose, you know, it's a bit again about managing expectations or whatever.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, listen, James, this has been great.
Cool.
Let me ask you a really annoying one to finish. Or maybe it's not annoying, actually. Who are your favourite producers?
I'm a big fan of the kind of thick 70s sort of Visconti sound. So I'll often pick someone like that. You know, I can't deny Eno's also made a lot of my favourite records. What are the favourite producers? I should think more about this. It's not something that I always think about. But I'll pick those two for now. I know they're pretty obvious, but there's lots of brilliant producers around. But yeah, they'll be my first go-tos.
Yeah, Tony Visconti. Do you ever listen to the Bob Lefsetz podcast?
I don't actually, no.
Okay, well, I would highly recommend the Bob Lefsetz podcast. Tony Visconti was on there recently for 2 hours talking about his classic career. And I have to say, he's a very entertaining person, as well as a great producer. So yeah.
Great.
Cool, man. Well, listen, thanks so much for your time. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Yeah, that was James Ford. What an interesting guy. What a impressive career. Bloody hell. Some amazing stories there. I mean, I think the one about mediating between members of Depeche Mode, that's just pretty incredible, right? But it's super interesting to hear about the nuts and bolts of producing those kinds of records. And I know as a listener to this show, there's a pretty decent chance you're an electronic producer. The world of record production is so much wider than that. And it's so interesting to hear how it can work and works in certain instances. You know, like the stuff about how Neil Tennant's voice sounds like the Pet Shop Boys with a triple track. That's so interesting. And, you know, Damon Albarn's voice and Graham Coxon just suddenly sound like Blur. That stuff is just fascinating, isn't it, really? So, yeah, absolutely great episode. Loved it. Totally lived up to last week. 100% 5 stars all around, I reckon. Okay, we're done. A reminder that you can get rid of the ads by joining us on Patreon, patreon.com/scubaofficial. If you don't want to do that, totally understand. Leave us a review or a rating. Follow the show. Leave us a gushing review. That would be nice. It all helps. Follow the Spotify playlist and join us in the Discord. I didn't say out at the front. Join us in the Discord. hotflashrecordings.com/discord gets you through to that Discord server. We'd love to have you there. Come and say hello. And head over to scubaofficial.io/live. London on the 12th of June, Bristol on the 13th of June, and Manchester on the 14th of June. Going to be a lot of fun. Hope to see you there. I will see you back here, though, same time, same place next week for the next episode of the Not a Diamond podcast. Thank you.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.